Good afternoon. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest today was here a couple of years ago with his movie Following, which was an amazing picture that I saw at the Slamdance Film Festival. And in the intervening time, his new picture, Memento, won the Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award at the Sundance Film Festival this year. It's a remarkable movie. He's Chris Nolan. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Elvis. Thanks for having me.
Your movies are so much about sort of perception and memory and playing with time. Where does that come from for you? How big an influence is Nicholas Roeg on your work, I would wonder?
Well, I'm a big fan of Roeg's work, and I think if you look back, I mean, particularly at, you know, the first 20 minutes or so of performance, you know, there's just this incredible display of non-linear editing and shifting time and different images from different points of the story to just create you know, type of narrative from that. So that's certainly a big influence. But other filmmakers, I mean, even back to Orson Welles, you look at the structure of Citizen Kane. I mean, it's still to this day an incredibly adventurous narrative structure. But I think my real interest is not so much, you know, shifting time for the sake of it. My real interest is points of view, you know, deciding what's the point of view we're trying to express in the story, whose eyes are we seeing the story through. And in the case of Memento, you know, it was very specifically, the structure is very specifically an attempt to see the events of the story through Leonard's eyes, basically.
But in both these movies, it's also about a deceptive point of view. You're basically telling the audience they think they're seeing what they're seeing, and in fact, they're not.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons I think I'm drawn to the thriller genre, or the film noir genre, is I think it plays into my own personal paranoia that, you know, can you really trust all the people around you and this kind of thing? And I think it's a powerful element to these stories because we can all relate to it so well. We all have to take those leaps of faith in small ways every day in terms of, you know, trusting the people we work with, the people we're in relationships with, and so forth. And I like the way that in a psychological thriller, in the film noir genre, you can just take those fears and extrapolate them. You know, you can exaggerate them into something more melodramatic that has a more universal language.
What's interesting about your movies, that I guess it's, at some point you're going to have to explain Memento, maybe Following for people too, but each scene plays in an anecdotal sense and adds up to something more. And I wonder where that comes from for you. You mentioned Citizen Kane, which is definitely a movie that does that. On the other hand, performance does not.
Well, I try not to be too conscious in acknowledging influences during the creative stage. I mean, even talking about Roeg, for example, is very much a product of looking at the finished film for me, or sitting there in the edit suite and looking at what we've done and then kind of figuring out where it came from in my head. So not quite sure, you know, how specifically I could answer that, except to say that the episodic nature of Memento appealed to me, because one of the things that appealed to me about the sort of central conceit was the idea of context, the context surrounding an action or an event. Motivation versus action, that kind of thing. So I became very drawn to the idea of creating a story comprised not just of a larger cycle, but of smaller cycles within that, and internal echoes and repetitions within that, so that you were constantly seeing either exactly the same thing or something very similar to something you've seen before, but interpreting it in a very different way because of the context. And for me, the whole movie relates to that very strongly, and that was what I was really interested in kind of exploring. So I think that what you call the sort of anecdotal side, the episodic nature of individual scenes connecting to create an overall effect, I was certainly interested mostly in exploring that question of motivation contrasted or motivation compared with action, and the revenge motif of the story is the kind of bedrock of that.
I guess that repetition too makes the movie play like a series of dreams.
Yeah, I think it does in a sense. I mean, the repetitions for me were sort of important because you want to also try and imply what's very important to the character, which is that repeated action is really the only way that he can retain information of any kind. He's lost his short-term memory. He's lost his conscious memory. And one of the ways he tries to make up for this is in systematizing his behavior. And what I found in the research I did was that the part of the brain that responds to habit, routine, to systematize behavior, to practice, is actually very different from the conscious short-term memory. So what he's trying to do in systematizing his life is to take on habits that can, he hopes, make up for his inability to consciously remember things. And in repeating things throughout the story, I think you start to get that sense of how his life is this kind of endless series of similar interludes. And very much, you know, he's constantly in the state of, as he describes in the film, like he just woke up, you know, like it is a dream he's just woken up from. And hopefully then the connections between these different repetitions become a little dreamlike, a little subconscious in a way. And certainly people who respond to the film seems to sort of live on in people's minds a little bit. And, you know, they seem to sort of extrapolate from the material they see on screen in terms of the relationships between the different scenes.
Where did it come from? I mean, was it there's a kind of co-credit in the screenplay, so how did that all happen?
Well, Memento is based on a short story that my younger brother Jonah wrote. It's just been published in Esquire, actually. But it took him a long time to get it in its finished form. And he actually told it to me verbally about 3 years ago while we were driving from Chicago to Los Angeles, just as I was finishing Following. And on the course of this trip, you know, he said, I'm working on this story, and it's about this guy with no short-term memory who's looking for revenge, and he's taken to using his body to record information in the form of tattoos. And I immediately said, you know, can I take that and write a screenplay from it while you write your story? And the first thing we agreed on, and once he'd said, yeah, go ahead, you know, do something with it, was that by far the most interesting way of approaching that concept was to try and tell the story in the first person. You know, he in his short story and myself in my screenplay.
But they're very different. I mean, I read the short story, and it's kind of funny you guys use the same taking off point, but they're very different pieces.
There are connections, though. It's interesting. And I think that Jonah also built a website for the film, which is at otmemem.com, which is Memento spelled backwards. And he, I think, in doing that website, created kind of an interesting narrative area to explore between the world of his story and the world of the film. They are very different, but some of the things they share, I think, are the alternation between the subjective and the objective voices, which we very much tried to do in the film between the color and the black and white sequences. And he in his story does, you know, he does that between the first person and the third person narration that eventually kind of meets, much as the black and white and color scenes meet in Memento. I think his story also uses the same idea of repetition and cycles, you know, actual repetitions and then echoes, you know, to kind of imply, you know, the state of mind of the character, really try and let you see things through his eyes.
I guess I see the echo in between the two being a kind of desperation. That's where they seem to be kind of linked to me.
Yes, but I think in his story you're seeing this character. It's actually, I think, a very different character, but one of the reasons it's a different character is it's a different character at a very different point in this story. Memento, I think there's a lot implied in Memento, the amount of tattoos he has and so forth and various other things in the story that to me has always implied that we're seeing quite a late cycle. You know, we're seeing him quite late in this development of who he is, and the story is much earlier. The story is, you know, years previously, but you never know how many years previously because of the nature of his condition. He can't orient himself in time. He doesn't know how much time has passed between, you know, losing his memory and being in the present state.
I guess, I'm sorry, I interrupted and asked you to tell them always about a little bit.
Yes, make all this a little bit clearer. The movie is it's a psychological thriller centered around the concept of a man named Leonard Shelby who's looking for revenge. He's looking for the guy who killed his wife. And the problem is he has no short-term memory, which is a real-life condition, anterior grade memory loss, in which you can't make new memories. It's different from conventional amnesia, if you like, or the usual form of amnesia that you see in films or whatever, in that he knows everything about himself. He knows all the objective information his long-term memory provides him with, you know, what his name is, where he was born, where he grew up, who he was married to, all this stuff. But at some point a few years before, he's lost the ability to make new memories. And I was fascinated by this idea of somebody who's struggling to reconcile their present self, you know, who they wake up and find looking back at themselves in the mirror, trying to reconcile that with all the information he knows about himself from his long-term memory. And it's that gap, you know, that is sort of implied by what happens in the film and is implied by what happens in the story as well, but never specified too closely.
How much research did you do? Did you read any Oliver Sacks on this kind of stuff at all? Or?
Not Sacks. I did a little bit of research, particularly through the internet, and I had Jonah did some research in the course of his story, but we didn't do too much because we were never interested in presenting a medical reality. I did enough to give me the confidence to go ahead and write the screenplay, knowing there was a scientific basis for these things, particularly in terms of the different types of memory that I wanted to explore in the film and the differences between them. But one of the things I found in my research is that all this is actually very poorly understood. And what I was really interested in exploring was the metaphorical potential of the condition. The other aspect to that is that I wanted to present everything in the story the way Leonard sees it, at least to begin with. And he sees his condition in quite simple, absolute terms. He has to, in order to believe that he can live with it, that he can work around it. So there's a sense in which the condition is presented in somewhat simplistic terms, at least at the beginning of the story. I think by the end you gain a slightly different impression of the detail of it. But in fact, I mean, people have seen the film, you know, medical people who work with people with this condition, and they actually found a lot in the film so they said, very true and very relevant, actually. I wrote the screenplay really as an extrapolation of my own process of memory, of examining my own process of memory and the way I use, you know, I mean, I'll write a phone number on my hand, I'll take a Polaroid picture of something, I'll, you know, keep a souvenir of something, all these things that when you start to examine them in detail, you know, if I were to tell you a, you know, string of 12 numbers, you know, 30 seconds later, you won't be able to tell me what they were. Once you start to examine the specifics of how interpretive your short-term memory is, rather than, you know, it's not a tape recorder, you know, as he says in the film, it is an interpretation, not a record. And the more I start to examine that and extrapolate from my own process of trying to absorb information and pass it into the long-term memory, the more fascinated I became with the way this character would live and what Guy Pearce, who plays Leonard, totally understood, and what we really connected with in coming together on the project was that this is not, you know, a portrait of a freak. This is not some, you know, medical drama or something like that. This is an everyman. This is an exaggeration of all of us. And what we really wanted to do is create a film that would hopefully have some members of the audience questioning their own short-term memory, questioning the way that they themselves, you know, absorb this information. Because we all proceed under this very confident assumption every day that we are accurately perceiving the world around us and filing this away as accurate information, and we tend to ignore the interpretive nature of that.
Well, it clearly isn't, because when I'm doing a lot of research on this myself, often this comes from trauma, this condition, which is explored in the film a little bit too. But how important was it to you to not give away too much of the cause of all this?
I think it was very important because the sort of inciting incident, or the point at which he receives this damage, whatever form, it seemed to me that if you're telling the story from his point of view, you know, this is the thing that in trauma cases or people who've suffered in this way, that tends to be a little bit blank. That tends to be the missing piece. So if you're seeing events very much from his point of view, it's very important to us to never be too explicit in exactly what's happened at that particular moment.
Just 2 minutes of treatment. My guest today is Chris Nolan. His new movie is The Amazing Memento. I guess I wonder why these puzzles, these film puzzles, mean so much to you. I guess I'm asking the same question in a number of ways, but I want to understand this, because Following is a series of puzzles too, basically, and you're offering the conventional narrative structure as unreliable.
Yes. I mean, I think Memento certainly is a lot about storytelling. It's a lot about filmmaking in a way. A lot about the way that we view ourselves in the world. You know, we are the sort of heroes of our own particular dramas going along. And I was fascinated and am fascinated by the sort of paradoxical nature of that. You know, you and I both sit here talking, and we're both the center of our own particular little narratives. And how do you reconcile that? You know, what's the area?
No, you're the center.
That?
I'm the unreliable narrator.
Exactly. But it is that, you see what I mean? It is that weird thing of, I mean, the tension, the film to me ultimately becomes about, and none of this is, I try not to be conscious of this sort of stuff when I'm writing the script, but when I look back at what the film is, to me what the film is fascinated by, and I think following this is true of as well, is the tension between our imprisonment in our own subjective view of the world and our unshakable faith that there is an objective reality outside of that. But we can never perceive it. And I think one of the things we go to films to see is to have a more comfortable experience of viewing this controlled universe in which the objective truth is presented. You know, and there are these kind of rules, and the filmmaker does at the end of it all say, okay, this is what the truth of this whole situation was. And I think that, you know, we find that to be a pleasurable experience, an escapist experience, because we don't ever get that in real life. And in Memento, we wanted to make a film that kind of didn't do that.
I guess I just find myself, as I was watching, for some reason, thinking of both Freud and DOA, you know, because there's that sort of sense of doom.
Yeah. Well, I think starting with the end of the story and working back, you're going to get a pretty doom-laden scenario. There's no way around. But, you know, no, absolutely. I've always loved the sort of, you know, classic film noir, you know, where you kind of know where the story's going. I mean, I was thinking more, I think, of Double Indemnity, you know, where they sort of begin the story, you know, at the end, and with Fred McMurray kind of stumbling into this office and then relating his story. And following has the same sort of concern. I quite like films where you actually, you know where you're going, and the process of the narrative is not so much what happens next as why has this thing happened. That, to me, becomes very interesting.
It's interesting, too, though, because it means you basically, when you're writing, I wonder how you work this out. If you actually sort of work out the scheme of the story and then decide at what point you're going to enter the story. And with something like Memento, how did that work?
Well, with Memento, it was a very different process than it was with Following. And I had absolutely no intention of doing another non-linear or non-chronological narrative after doing Following.
Was it because with Following you basically were putting it together basically sort of week by week?
Yeah, you know, Following had a pretty fractured production process, and to tell the story in a fractured way kind of suited that very well. When I came to the story of Memento, once Jonah and I had decided, as we did very early on, right from the get-go, that what we wanted to do is put the audience into this guy's head to make them suffer his perceptual distortion for a couple of hours, and in that way, hopefully make them think about certain things we were fascinated by in the story. And the structural solution to doing that was, okay, we want to withhold the information from the audience that is withheld from the protagonist. Telling the story backwards is a way of doing that, and basically that's the structure of the film. It is a story told backwards. But it came about as a result of that particular question. How do we tell this in the first person? Because there is no effective first-person narrative in films. You know, the grammar of film is a more objective grammar, so you have to sort of find structural ways.
Do you really think that that's objective? Because I guess I do not.
Well, it isn't objective, no. You're right, but it appears to be objective.
Oh, sure.
Which is why I think it's very powerful to use it in a subjective way, in a more subjective way, an even more subjective way than most films do, rather than having the author of the film or the director or whoever be the head through which you're seeing things, which is certainly subjective. But to try and, you know, elide that, to try and combine that rather with the perspective of one of the characters in the story, then I think it becomes very effective. Because even in literature, you know, when you're reading a book written in the first person, you're constantly seeing that first person pronoun. You're constantly aware of the fact that you're being told the story very subjectively. As indeed, if you look at, you know, The Lady in the Lake or whatever, you know, when you're shooting from a first person, it's very hard to ever lose that and get drawn into that.
It doesn't quite work because of that.
No, exactly. So that's what I mean when I say there isn't a literal first person, because film grammar is, you know, the camera is outside physically outside of the characters. You're seeing what they're seeing, then you're seeing their reaction to it, and that has the illusion of objectivity. So what I'm trying to do in a film like Memento is to use that physically objective grammar in a more subjective storytelling method, you know, to try and create a more subjective narrative. And I think when that works, it's very powerful because you're not as aware of it, as I say. So the structure came about as a result of really trying to create that subjective narrative. And in fact, I didn't write anything didn't write anything at all before coming up with that approach to the story. And to me, the structure and the story are one and the same. They are totally inseparable. People are often saying to me, can you, you know, reorder the film and view it in a chronological sense? And my answer is, you can. Logically, it holds up. I felt that was important because you're inviting all kinds of logical scrutiny by adopting this unconventional structure. But it's a completely different story. I mean, it's the narrative is entirely different. Your perception of the character is entirely different. And to me, that was very important. And that's why I wrote the script the way it appears on screen, which is not what I did with Following. With Following, I wrote it. I always had the structure in mind, but I wrote a chronological story and then divided it up. What I found is I then had to do an enormous amount of rewrite work to make it work as the narrative I wanted on screen. So what I did with Memento is I just sat down and I started writing from page one, and I wrote the film that I wanted to see on screen. I then had to go back and do a lot of work, you know, to sort of check the logic of it and everything.
How much work did you end up having to do after it's done, basically, to sort of make sure all the pieces fit together, because it's very intricate.
It is very intricate, and I did have to do quite a lot of work sort of scene to scene. I think I was just so excited by the whole process, though, that I found it easier than I should have. You know, I just kind of got through it, and then once I had it on the page, I would go back and check the particular logic. It was very difficult to rewrite. The writing wasn't so tough, but with that structure, anytime you change anything in a scene, there are all kinds of ramifications in both directions in the script. So it's a very complex rewrite process you go through on a script like that. But I was just enjoying myself with it, so it was it didn't feel like as hard work as it should have, probably.
What was it like to go from being at Slam Dance with Following to being at Sundance with Memento, basically 2 years later?
Well, I didn't have to walk up the hill quite so often. it was great, actually. I mean, it was a slightly different vibe, but what both festivals share is just this, you know, audiences just really looking for something, you know, really attentive and really enthusiastic, which is tremendous. I had a lot more fun at Sundance than I thought I would.
How do you mean?
I figured it would be very intense. It was very intense. You know, there's a whole, with a bigger film, you know, Following was this no-budget film. So it was pretty low pressure, in fact. We were just kind of grubbing for whatever interest we could get. So when you turned up at the screening, we were like, wow, that's a bit of a coup. That was, you know, the biggest thing that happened to us, I think.
That's the saddest thing I've ever heard in my life.
No. It was great. I mean, it's so satisfying when you have a tiny movie that you know, everything you do that kind of makes it bigger, everything you do that gets it out there is a bonus. With a bigger movie, and Memento is, to me, a much bigger movie.
Did you submit Following to Sundance?
No comment.
Okay.
I don't want to get bogged down in that kind of nonsense. What we found with Memento was, it, you know, I think, okay, we've got to get, you know, we've got to get all this press, we've got to really, you know, get to it, and you forget about what the festival really represents, which is an opportunity to get these, you know, audiences who are just fascinated to see something new and something different.
See, that's what I was wondering, because it seems the difference, that so far as I can tell, is it goes from being Slam Dance, where you really just want people to come see the picture,
yeah,
to going to Sundance, where in effect you have a political campaign.
Yeah, but we didn't, partly because we had a distribution already in place, we didn't find it quite like that, or at least I didn't. Maybe I was protected from it, you know, have sort of more people helping you out. But the thing I really came away with was just how much fun it was to screen the film there, how much fun it was to get audiences who are really, in a way, on your side. You know, they're looking for something different. They're excited to sort of come and see something a little bit unconventional, and they responded very well to that. You know, and then we won a prize, so that was cool.
Tell me what the first screening at Sundance was like. Where was it?
The first screening was at the Sundance Institute, which, you know, is sort of out of the main town and all that. And it's a different sort of audience and all the rest. And it was great. I mean, it was tremendous. You know, it was sold out and all that. I mean, all our screenings were sold out. And that's so exciting as a filmmaker, you know, when people are kind of trying to get tickets to your film and they're asking you if you've got the spare tickets and all that. I mean, that's so much fun. And most of our screenings were at the library, which was great. And it was just a great atmosphere there. Had a lot of fun.
It's interesting because, you know, the film doesn't fit into kind of the Sundance paradigm of dysfunctional family at all. You know, dysfunctional family melodrama. It's a genre picture which is not really a strength of the festival or has not been in the past.
Hasn't it?
No.
I don't know. I mean, I wasn't that aware. There seemed to be some other thrillers this year, you know, The Deep End and things like that, which unfortunately as a filmmaker you don't get a chance to see anybody else's
Is
film,
that
which
true? Did you not get to see anything
I
else?
didn't get to see anything else, which was great in a sense because it meant that I was busy doing press, and you know, that's obviously a huge boost for the film, so that's kind of what you're there for. But you really don't get a chance to see other people's films. I just did the only film I got to see was Chris Munch's Sleepy Time Gal, which I thought was great. But just didn't have a chance to see anything else, unfortunately.
What was the one question you kept getting asked up there? I mean, how do you get your movie here, or what do people want to know?
What about Sundance?
Yeah, when you were there, when you were being, doing all the press conferences, what were you?
The only recurring questions are the really boring ones about, you know, what was your budget? You know, and do you have distribution and all that kind of stuff, you know. The bulk of the questions varied greatly from screening to screening and were much more, you know, exciting to me, much more about what's the film, you know, what do you mean by the film basically, you know, and what's happening at the end and what's this and what's that. And, you know, we seem to get a lot of really quite exciting questions about Memento itself, you know, and so forth, which for me obviously is a lot more interesting.
I just wonder if that kind of situation and those questions from an audience that really wants to figure out what you're trying to do changes your perception of the film in some way.
It does enormously, and the thing with a film like Memento is in having the terms of the storytelling be so subjective and basically in a way attempting to adopt or at least to make my view of what's going on in the film no more important than anybody else's interpretation as they're watching. You wind up with an incredible variety of response to the film. And right after Sundance, I went to Rotterdam in the Netherlands and screened the film there. And the audience responded in a completely different way and had completely different questions. You know, the questions over there were incredibly detail-oriented about tiny, tiny plot specifics, you know, and little connections between things. Whereas in Sundance, the questions had been much more thematic and so forth. The fun thing about a lot of these questions is that a lot of people answer their own question as they ask it. You know, they'll sort of be like, is this what you intended? You know, blah, blah, blah. And the answer is, yes, it is. You know, are we supposed to know this or are we supposed to have to make up our own mind? And the answer is, yeah, you are. There are certain ambiguities in the film that I was interested in exploring, hopefully in a productive way, not in a frustrating way. But I felt that to be true to the terms of the storytelling, you really had to push the audience into making certain of the same judgments that Leonard has to make.
And making them trust the movie, which is weird knowing that they really can't trust it, but you have to engender that, don't you?
You do, and it's partly a process of, in a quite bald way, through the film stating, you can't trust this. And the film quite literally does that at various points in the movie. I mean, either through the dialogue or through the images you're actually seeing and the way they change. But Leonard very early on says, you know, about not being able to trust memory and all the rest. And that's his point of view, because he doesn't have a healthy functioning memory anymore. So, but it creates this kind of paradox he's in where he's trusting his long-term memory, but he's explaining at the same time how interpretive the whole process is.
Kind of here, Chris. Thanks for coming back. And next time we'll try and do it live so we can make you sweat a little bit more. I guess it's Chris
Please
Nolan.
no.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
The movie's Memento. Our technical director today is Bob Carlson. Mary Holdridge produces the program. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment, 89.9 KCRW.